Somebody's
Hello.
online. Hello.
Hi.
Happy birthday!
Whose birthday is it?
I don't know. It says it's your birthday. Is it lying? Skype says it's your birthday.
Oh, it's not my birthday.
I didn't think so.
My birthday was in February.
Oh, shit. I must have not talked to you in a while. It says it's Rob's birthday today.
That's weird.
It has been a while.
Yeah.
It hasn't been since February, surely.
You've been gone for years,
You've been
don't you
gone
realize?
forever.
It's
You
been
fell
that
into
long,
the
huh?
Disney vortex.
Well, we had a good time.
That's where
The
I
kids
was.
had
Such a
a
good
good
time.
time that the world moved on without you.
I guess so. Well, the kids had a great time. It was the first time they went, and it was we couldn't ask for anything more. It was great.
It's a magical kingdom. What can you expect?
I know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was nice. It was real nice.
Yeah, I call you and it says it's Rob Krieger's birthday today.
I just checked
But then I look
my
at the
thing. It
last
says
time
2:10.
we've messaged and it says February 10th.
Yep, that's it.
Yeah.
How are you guys?
I was in a rush. I hardly took a long walk today. She slowed me down, and by the time I got back, it was already 8:30. And I didn't run my tests because I don't trust Skype, so I always test.
Yeah.
But it was a rough walk. I'm still not back recuperated.
Yeah. Did Chris, how have you been recently?
Well, last time Mike and I were gonna record, I couldn't because my wife was not feeling well, and so I was taking care of stuff that she usually does.
Oh yeah.
It happened to be that weekend that she was feeling her worst, and then a few days after that, once she got better, I got sick.
Oh,
So
great.
I was sick for about a week. I'm still kind of not 100%, still sort of clearing out some of the congestion, so I might put myself on mute frequently, but
I definitely got a cold after coming back, and it's, I mean,
you got
it seems to be getting better, but
the Disney crud.
my wife was having cold symptoms there, so I know it was just a matter of time. And sure enough, it was like literally the day we were coming back. I'm like, yeah, I can tell I'm getting sick.
Well, the probability of you getting sick at a major park or a major convention or anything where a bunch of people are touching stuff is highly
Yeah.
probable.
And then it
Yeah.
goes even up even higher when you have two
Kids.
5-year-olds that
Yeah.
literally touch everything that they
Yeah,
see.
they're licking the
Yeah.
sidewalk and stuff
They're base. Yeah, that's basically it. They're
and
doing, I mean, they're touching things that you wouldn't come close to, and you tell them to stop, but it's already too late. So,
they have
but
it in their mouth.
yeah, they already got in the room. Oh my God.
And
Yeah.
then,
But no, I got to tell you a funny story because we went, Chris, have you been to Disney World?
not anytime recently. I mean, when I was a kid,
Yeah. And Mike, how long ago were you there? Basically, I'm.
three years probably, three or
Was
four.
that Seven Dwarves Mine roller
Yeah,
coaster there?
I
Okay.
was there. Yeah.
So last time we had been there was
Highly
7 years ago.
disappointed in that ride, by the way.
Oh, I thought it was great.
Oh
But
no, in terms of roller coaster, it's lightweight.
well, it is.
For
That's everything at Disney
kit,
is
everything
lightweight.
at Disney is lightweight. You go to Universal and it's like, I don't know, it just
Well,
they
I
have that
have to say
Matterhorn stuff and it's pretty cool, but
I have to say that that's my mode is lightweight as well. So I enjoy it. And then being there with the kids, we got there in the unfortunately it was a little later than we wanted. So it was the late afternoon on Monday, and our fast pass for that roller coaster was going to expire within like a half an hour because we got there later than we thought we were going to.
so you have to hit there
And
first.
So we went right there, right? Now, we're with 2 5-year-olds who literally have never been on any roller coaster. Their Allie won't go on any, like, rides at all, you know, at, at the county fair or any carnivals and stuff like that. She just won't go on any of them unless it's, like, just, like, the merry-go-round or whatever.
Yeah, the car's going around in a circle or something like that.
So... We're like, okay, we got that. And you know how those typical Disney rides are. You can't see a whole lot, like, from the outside. So we go in there, and I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, this could be the worst mistake. We're going to go on this ride. If they freak out, we could be done with rides for, like, the whole trip.
Yeah.
At least as far as they're concerned. But we went on. My family came too. My mom and dad came, and Stacy's mom came. So Allie wanted to sit with my wife. Zach wanted to sit with my dad. So I'm sitting by myself next to just some strange lady. I have no idea. Like, I'm enjoying the roller coaster, but I'm like, oh God. Like, I have no idea if they're liking it or not liking it. I get off and I see Allie crying, right? I'm like, oh, no, this is not good.
It's going to be the worst thing ever.
Right, because what are we going to do? She's not going to go on anything else.
Yeah.
So we get a little closer. I see that Zach is laughing and stuff like that. I'm like, well, he liked it. And I get up to Stacy and Allie, and Stacy turns to me and says she's crying because she didn't want it to be over yet.
Oh,
I'm like,
awesome.
Oh, I'm like, all right, we are good to go now for this trip.
No, that's so you wanted to. That actually could have worked to your benefit. Like, that was because if you have somebody that's timid for rides and they don't know what they're getting into, it could work to your advantage, or just like you said, it could be their downfall. Like, for the rest of their life.
It could have been one or the other. Yeah.
Right. It could be traumatizing and they'll never want to ride again.
Yeah.
This time it worked in your favor, so that's.
Oh, cool. We were lucky. It was great from there on out. I mean, they were, you know, they're young, so, you know, they got cranky on occasion and stuff, and, you know, we got cranky on occasion, but overall, I mean, they were awesome for the trip, and they loved every
ride
they're on.
Good ride for a fast pass for sure.
Because yeah,
we waited in line, and that was, I think it was like. The inaugural year that came
out,
or maybe. Mm-hmm. And it was like 2 hours
before
we got there. And then when we rode it, yeah, they have all those weird screens that you can play games and stuff on the way there, you know, like pick a diamond and all this stuff. But, man, I was so underwhelmed because of the weight. And I was like, holy
moly.
That
does hurt you sometimes.
It was like... I mean, there's a couple roller coasters at Disney that I like. One of them is the train, the Mountain Rocky Thunder, whatever it is.
Oh yeah, they like that.
They had a comic
big,
book on
Big Thunder Mountain. Yeah.
Yeah, Thunder Mountain. I like that one a lot, and I like the one that's at the Animal Kingdom, the whatever it
Expedition
is.
Expedition Everest.
Yeah, that one.
The Yeti.
Did you ride that?
We didn't ride it this time around because I knew that they were too small.
Well,
it's
a little more mature. But
I've been on it before. I thought it was awesome.
Oh yeah, I love the surprises in that ride. Like,
yeah.
I had no idea it had a backward forward. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was like, this is awesome. You don't usually see that in roller coasters, like a backward forward thing. That's pretty awesome.
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah.
That's pretty unique. That's what made that thing stand out for me, because I didn't know. Like, I was like, holy crap.
Yeah, there were just a handful of rides that were too short to go on.
Yeah.
That would have been one of them. That Avatar ride constantly had a 2-hour wait, but we had a fast pass for that, too. Stacy stayed with the kids, and then the rest of us went on that one, and that was really cool.
That one there when I went.
Yeah, that's an Animal Kingdom. It was really, really fun. That was a lot of fun.
Did you take him to the Bug's Life? I thought that was really fun. The one that was
on
the tree. I just love that it's like 4D and they added smell to the sound to the thing. I found that was like the most fascinating 4D I've ever. I mean, when you got a bug that farts. I mean, you have me sold. I mean, and it stinks. I mean, it's like a god awful smell. It's like, wow, whoever imagined—they call their Imagineers. Whoever did that, I give props to, because
that's a good one.
It should affect your sight, smell, you know, it should affect everything.
Oh, the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. And it did. It was like, man, this smells like ass. It's awful.
Allie got a little frightened at one point because it got dark and mist came out.
Yeah.
The grasshopper came. He was spraying people with bug spray. So she got scared during that part. But other than that, she liked it. And Zach liked the entire thing.
Yeah. That's cool. I'm glad.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. Well, we had the youngins with us when we went, my brother's kids. So I kind of know what you were experiencing.
It's fun to see like their reactions for the first time. And like we had a brunch that, at our hotel, and Lilo's and Stitch were there, but then Mickey came. And this is just a cute little story because, Zach was, he was real shy at first. He didn't say anything to Lilo. He kind of just waved to Stitch and talked to him, but that was it. But Mickey came, he got out of his seat and gave him a big hug. And then he came back to me and he's like, "Dad, Mickey's real. He's real." I go, "I know." He goes, "He's not a robot. He's not a statue. There's nobody inside him. He's real."
Yeah.
Oh my God, that just made my whole trip, just seeing that, you know, from him. It was awesome. So anyhow, I had a great time.
Sounds like a blast. I want to, a matter of fact, I've been seeing commercials for it lately, and I'm like, God, I really need that. I need to be gone for a week like that.
It's nice when you go to somewhere like that, and not that you can't do that anywhere else, but for some reason that seems to be special with me and my family. Is like I totally forget about anything going on, like in the real world.
That's what I love about it. You're at another place, and not only that, but a lot of times you don't need transportation. It's all taken care of for you. You go from park to park. It's like you're in a freedom zone of happiness for a week. Nope. And I would I would highly recommend to anybody that hasn't experienced it, if you stay at like the Disney resorts and you just let transportation take you.
Yeah, it was
awesome. You order pizza at 2 a.m. I mean, it's like, it's just like the rules are all gone, and it's just like just a happy place. It makes me want to be there right now. Because I have to go to work tomorrow, and God dang it, I don't want to.
Yeah,
I want to be at Disney World.
First day after 2 weeks off, it's going to be rough.
Yeah.
Well, it was a great time, though.
I love it. Except for me, I get the kicks more out of Universal, but I think it's because it's... Like your kids will... I think they'll change their minds if they like roller coasters and stuff around the ages of 12 to 14. You know, that's where the mode changes. Like me and Bill Boner like the roller coasters. Bill Boner. They have a rock and roll roller coaster where you choose your song. It's so awesome.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty extreme. Like I thought I was gonna lose my phone on one of them. It was bad. I was screaming like to the top of my lungs. I was trying to keep the phone in while my arms are braced because you can't move them down the way the thing straps on you. And it was like I was clenching my butt cheeks and trying to move things a certain way just to keep my phone in my pocket.
You got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
The other thing I just want to ask you guys about, and this is, it's not retro, but I wanted to just ask anyhow. Did you see A Quiet Place? And Chris, had you seen that?
No.
I did. I saw it.
Oh my God. I saw it by myself because I knew that wouldn't be something Stacy wanted to see since I was off this week. Holy crap. I thought that was amazing. What did you think, Mike?
I thought it was pretty amazing. I thought it was a weird experience because I felt weird eating popcorn because you're in absolute quiet. Like, there's no sound. So it's like the guy next to me is like, he's hearing every crunch I'm doing, you know? It's like... It's probably annoying him, but then he started eating his popcorn, so I was like, okay, we're good. I'm going to keep eating.
But... Yeah, I had a candy bar. I'm like, when am I going to open this up? I had to wait for at least some, like, suspenseful music to play to, before I could even open it, because it's so dead quiet in the theater.
I liked it a lot, but there was things I'm like, these people are dumb people, man. I swear to God. I kept, like, just shaking my head at some of them, because I'm like, oh, my God. They're just ridiculously dumb with some things, like one of the things that's a major plot point. Like, why would you do that in a world like that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I liked how they set it up that it was going to be, you know, there were going to be consequences, things were going to happen to, you know, characters. And just the way that they decided to end it, I thought that was a cool ending.
I think it was like special, too, that the guy who wrote it and directed it from The Office, that's his wife. That's in real life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think those quiet moments between them, I think they were, like, legit. Like, I mean, they felt pretty emotional.
Yeah.
It was almost like they didn't have to act. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
oh, yeah,
that's your spouse. So it was pretty powerful. I enjoyed it.
I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. So Chris, I recommend when it comes out on streaming to give it a watch.
Yeah, I think I've heard it's good. I think I'd rather watch it that way, because I'm not a huge movie theater fan in the first place, and I think it would annoy me to have to watch it with other people.
For me, I think it works better at the theater because there are no distractions. It's just, I don't know, it's in your face quietness, and at the house they'll never be that.
For me, it would be more quiet at home. I mean, I wouldn't want to have to deal with, like you said, other people making noises and stuff. I even heard, like, at some theaters you can hear movies playing in the other theater.
Experience that. Whatever was playing next door was a loud movie, and I did hear that a couple times.
I didn't, but I think I'm going deaf, so it's highly likely. I really think that I'm going to lose my hearing by, I don't know, a decade. I'm a decade off.
You think so?
Yeah, just the way things are going. It's getting worse and worse since I had that incident. So.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but, well, hopefully it won't be that bad. I think when you get older, everyone loses their hearing to some extent.
The only thing that I have is the hearing aid chart is invert to what my condition is. So, like, the hearing aid boost won't help the frequencies that I need it at.
Really?
Yeah. Oh.
Which ones do you have problems with?
Well, it's an inverse slope of aging.
Oh.
So the ear chart is the opposite of a normal degradation of hearing loss. I had sudden hearing loss in chart. But, like, it's weird because I didn't think a hearing aid would work for my mom either, because I tried it. I tried a hearing aid for a long time, and it didn't do anything. It boosted sounds that I don't give a shit about, but, like, the vocal range, it would not help at all. Mm. But my mom, it, like, worked wonders. Like, she can hear now. It's like something weird. Like, she was always hesitant. I'm like, Mom, yes, it's expensive and it's a chance, but you have, like, a 2-week window where you spend a lot of money, but if it works, you really feel better because you can hear.
Right. Yeah.
And it worked for her, and she's able to hear, and it's pretty incredible.
My dad has one too, and I think it's only a matter of time before I'll need one. I mean, I didn't take care of my ears and stuff going to concerts and stuff, and, you know,
well,
in my
didn't
20s
either,
and 30s.
But for me, it's hereditary. Like,
right, I mean, you got a separate problem apart from that. I've just got the normal, you know, not taking care of yourself when you're younger type thing.
Yep. Yeah, that's a cool movie. I really liked it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
There's a lot of horror
that's
movies
one I'll
out
buy.
I want to see.
What were you just saying? You
There's a lot of horror movies that I wouldn't mind seeing. I just haven't been able to get to the. I saw Avengers, but I haven't been going to the movies every week like I normally do.
Yeah.
So I missed a couple of weeks. And usually those horror movies are out 1 week and or maybe 2 weeks at max, unless you're a blockbuster like that one.
Yeah,
Like
exactly.
every now and then they make a film for a couple $1 million, and this one probably costed more because of the special effects, but
But it's still a
it is still
low
re
budget
way
overall.
cheaper than a lot of other films, and
Exactly.
they make bank, man. I mean, they make
Yeah.
huge bank.
Yeah.
I mean, you see what it did for, what is his name, Peele? I mean, holy crap.
Oh my God, Get Out. Yeah.
He made so much money.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with those horror movies is that they're typically a low budget film, and every once in a while something just hits and
Yeah,
blows up.
you catch gold, and you catch gold in a big way. You make so much
Yeah.
money that you're set if you know what to do with your money.
Oh yeah. I didn't see Ready Player One. I kind of had wanted to, but now at this point, I'm just going to wait for it to be on streaming.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, but for some reason, I had no interest in it. I don't know why.
I read the book. The book was fantastic. If you're a person who grew up in the time frame that I did, because I think I'm the same age as that guy, like late 70s through the 80s, it's like, I mean, the whole premise of the book anyhow is just all like retro gaming and stuff, Atari, especially Atari, a lot of Atari stuff.
Yeah, I love that Atari system, but that Atari, I think once ColecoVision left, not ColecoVision, I think once the Dreamcast is as far as when I started to lose interest after the Dreamcast, right after it, I was like, I don't think video games are for me anymore.
Yeah.
Well,
I had a.
go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, you go ahead. I was just going to say that I had a brief. Briefly, I got into the GameCube and I actually played a lot of games on that, but that was pretty much it for me. I didn't do anything in between that, like when the time frame you're talking about in the GameCube, and then the GameCube came and went, and I was pretty much out.
Because I played sports games, I mean they were a big part of my life. When I lost friends that played the sports games with, I lost interest in the gaming system entirely.
Yeah.
So even though now you have the technology to play over online, you know what I mean?
Yep.
But so can I kick us off with this week?
Yeah, please,
Because
sir.
I know you've read this, Rob, coincidentally, but
Yes, and it's funny because I've got something that maybe I'll follow you with after yours.
for one thing, I went and bought all the Action Comics 1000 issue covers that were solicited in the years. So like if it went from 1940 to or 1930 to 19
To the
To the
2000s.
2000s, yeah. So it was a
I
lot of
did too.
covers. And I thought
Mine just came yesterday.
the earlier covers were freaking amazing. Like
They were beautiful.
for me, the Steve Rude one stole it by a
Was that
landslide.
the 30s or the
Yeah,
40s one?
is the earliest one.
That's nice.
The 40s one I liked a lot. And then there was
I liked some of the retro
Michael
ones, like the 50 and
Allard,
60 ones were cool
yeah.
too.
Well, that one was true to the time. It had the
Yeah.
checkerboard on the cover. And it had a lot going on in the cover, and back then that's what they had. Like it had the quadrant thing. Here's Superman doing this, Superman doing that. Here's this, and I like
I
that
didn't notice
throwback.
until I was looking at all of them how they were faithful to what the logo was during those time frames as well. Like the logo for each decade is actually different based on how it actually was back in those time frames. I didn't catch that in the solicits. I thought they were all the same logo, and they're
Yeah.
not. That's really cool.
Yeah, they did the logos right. I liked it too, 'cause man, it was like selling through at the comic store, 'cause it was just like people going. I mean, it was like one of those little events where people were excited about comics again. like the death of Superman, not to that extreme where people were waiting out line, but there was a lot of people, a lot of flow of people buying an $8 comic book because it's an expensive comic book. Matter of fact, if you look at all the covers, which I didn't get, you have to, there's a lot of exclusives through other shops. There are some beauties out there, man. There's like three of them that I was like, holy moly, drooling over. But
I was just looking at them in our in the database and just looking through to see how many there were.
That's how I was looking at them. I was like, I wonder if they, because sometimes our database is really good about covers and sometimes they're not with variants. And I was like, wow, they have most of them here, like from all the comic shops and stuff. So anyway, I bought the, it was solicited as Action Comics 1000 hardcover. At least that's what it was when I read it. And then it came out as Action Comics 80 Years of Superman Deluxe Edition hardcover. And I thought it would still have the Action 1000 in it, but it didn't. But the shocking thing that I was amazed at with this thing is I never read Action Comics number one.
I saw you post that. I cannot believe that.
I can't believe it either. I'm like, what the hell? I could have sworn I had it. And then as an original issue, but I had it in some form like to read, and I don't. Yeah. This is like, well, I think it's in 75 Years of Superman as well. But I hadn't read it. But I didn't buy like the Chronicles of Superman like I did the Flash and Green Lantern. I didn't buy any of the reprints before. And they've had like Millennium series come out with reprints and a bunch of stuff like that. And I never bought them. So this was like my first exposure to Action Comics number one. And I was really blown. I didn't expect any of this. This is a crazy story, man. One of the things
you can tell that it's kind of, you can tell these early issues were kind of written with newspaper strips in mind as well. I can see how they could have broken
it
up.
Very much so. It's like it's like reading a Sunday funny kind of thing, where it's like there's not much flow from one strip to the other. That was one of the shocking things. The other thing is they never mentioned. Like, his origin was in three panels. He's, like, rocketed from a distant planet, and then he arrives, and a family picks him up. Nope. And he's a baby lifting a couch. Unnamed family, unnamed planet. Everything is unnamed. And then it gives like, a newspaper strip of his powers. Oh, he could leap tall buildings in a single bound. He could beat a train and, you know, lift a lot of weight. And then it has a little scientific explanation of his strength by talking about ants and crickets. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? I'm sorry, but this was ridiculous. And then the plots they're wonderful. Like, they're wonderfully short and wonderfully strange from anything I've ever read because – like I started reading the comic you guys got me for my birthday, the Smash comics or Crack comics with the Black Condor, and that one was very streamlined, like it flowed well, you know. This one is really really choppy because it's got like four stories in it. One story he's like carrying a blonde woman and she's tied up. And she has a cloth around her mouth.
I think that's how it started, didn't it? That's like, how, this blonde girl?
It starts. He's just jumping. Yeah. And he's going to, like, this governor's house. And he's like, you know, we got to stop this execution. And they're gonna electrocute. That's one of the other things I found fascinating. I guess I never realized that we had the electric chair this early in life. Because they had an electric chair. He was there to save a woman's life, and he said the guilty woman is right out there tied to a tree.
Yep.
And I thought that was hilarious. And then he just randomly says something's going on. I hear something happening. There's a woman getting beat. There's a wife beating going on. And then he shows up, And he like beats the crap out of the guy, and he's like, "Hey, you like beating up on women? What do you like now?" And he's like beating the shit out of the guy, and he passes out. He's gonna stick a knife in him, and he just passes out because he's like fainted from stress.
Yeah.
And they arrest him, and then the other story with the gangster. This is my favorite because it has Lois's first appearance and kind of like Perry's. I don't know if Perry's named.
Lois. He wasn't named. No.
Lois is definitely named, but they work together, and it sounds like Lois at this time was writing like women's gossip columns. That's another thing that's fascinating. She wasn't like that front page reporter that I'm used to seeing.
She's exactly. writing,
doing like gossip columns. He invites her on a date. He takes her out, and there's a bunch of gangsters out there. And he's like, "Okay, get out of the way." You know, they're dancing, and this guy wants to dance with Lois, and Clark says, "Well, no, you can't do that. This isn't a robber's dance. I don't know what the hell a robber's dance is, but I can't steal somebody's date away at a robber's dance." And he just lets it happen. And this gangster tries to say, "Hey, you're going to dance with me." And Lois says, "Screw that. We're leaving right now." And then slaps the guy. And this guy starts to beat up on Clark, and she's so mad at Clark because he does not like lift a finger to do anything. It's also fascinating.
He had to keep his cover.
Yeah, and then these goons go after them in the car, and this is where the famous scene of cover number one is because he's lifting the green car, and he gets all the gangsters out of the car. And leaves the guy on a lamppost. I mean, not a lamppost, but a telephone pole. He leaves him hanging there and saves Lois. And then next day, Lois comes in and says, "Perry, I think I saw Superman." And he thinks she's crazy.
Yep.
He says, "Are you sure it wasn't pink elephants you saw?" And, and then he tells Clark to go do his job and go over to some remote island in Santa Monte and get some news. And then he doesn't even follow that. He goes somewhere to Washington, D.C. with politicians, which is fascinating because this is 1930. And they're already – it's so contemporary because this guy is giving money to a politician, a senator, to do something. And I found it, like, fascinating for the time period. And then it just leaves him on a cliffhanger – because he captures this lobbyist, and he takes him to Washington D.C. to be on trial, I guess, and it just ends there. He's like jumping in the sky, and he's like, "Missed, doggone it!" Like he missed the building, and they're both gonna fall.
Right,
and
it says
to be continued. Because he can't fly, he's jumping, and he missed where he was supposed to get. He goes, "Oops, missed. To be continued." I don't know. I can't, for one thing, I can't believe I never read it. And for the other thing, I can't believe how much was in it and how much it was choppy. It was like scene to scene to scene, like four different stories.
I can see it as a newspaper strip because each like thing could have been a different newspaper strip. And then the next day or whenever it was, a couple of days later, you know, there's a new, brand new story that has nothing to do with what you just read, you know, before.
Yeah.
But reading it as a comic book, it's like it's just jumping from one story to the next.
It got me so excited. I got like really excited last night because I read this like I wasn't even planning on talking about it, but I had just finished the Clone Saga, and I'm like, I finished another trade. For some reason, I've been wanting to read trades. I get in these modes. And I'm in a trade mode. And I just said, you know what? I'm going to pick up this Action Comics and read it. And I was just, I can't believe I was blown away by this. I was like, this is the most, I was trying to interrupt Barb during the, she was watching one medical drama that she watches. And I was like, "Barb, I can't believe this is happening." And she wanted to watch your show. I was interrupting her. I don't know. It blew me away. And then I read the Zatara story.
Yeah.
And that was also his first appearance. And fascinating because He is Zatanna's father, and he is doing his magic with backward speak. So I thought that was pretty amazing. And
That
that.
surprised me as well, that from the very first appearance, that's how they decided to do that, and it's still true today with Zatanna. It's kind of
Yeah.
cool.
And it was that was a cooler, like, streamlined adventure. Like
Oh yeah.
they were trying to find these guys that were hijacking materials on a train, on these high speed trains. And it turns out that one of the guards of the train was in on it, and he was letting these people know ahead of time. He was marking the cars, and then they would go and swap out the materials during the transport, and then move like boxes in it, and then steal the other stuff. And Zatara had a he had an interesting sidekick with him, but he was like the muscle of the. The group, I can't remember what his name was. It was
Don't either. He was an Indian guy.
Yeah, his name is Tong.
Oh yeah.
He was a shirtless dude that wore like a headdress type thing. And he was like the muscle for the group, but man, this was pretty sophisticated. And the other thing I'm really becoming a fan of, and I don't think I've ever been a fan of before is I'm starting to the Golden Age style of artwork is really, really clicking with me lately. Like really clicking with me, and it's never done it. Like I am weak in the Golden Age, but I definitely want to explore it a lot more. I tell you, this Superman story was awesome.
Did you read any of the intro before the
I started,
stories?
but I didn't get to finish. But go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say when they talked about Zatara a little bit and basically they say that he's identical to Mandrake the Magician, who had already been in newspaper syndication,
Yeah.
and that apparently Mandrake had a giant half-naked black African as
Yeah.
an assistant, and Zatara has a giant half-naked East Indian as an
Yeah, it's
assistant.
very
And
strange.
basically, yeah, they just took one thing and just
They
changed it
stole
just
it.
a little
Yeah.
bit. Yep. Yeah,
It was
it's fun.
I look forward like I'm gonna this is on hardcover I'm gonna finish next. And I'll probably finish it pretty fast. I already started action number two.
Oh,
And
well, if you don't mind, could I go next?
yeah, go ahead.
Well, because I hope I don't spoil this for you, but I picked action number two.
Yeah, go ahead. I
All
have it in
right.
front of me so I could follow along.
It's just weird that I had already planned to do action two when I saw your post. I'm like, oh my God, Mike's doing action one. So it picks up, Mike, exactly where it left off the issue before. Where he's got that guy under his arm
Yeah,
and
the
he's falling,
lobbyist.
yeah, the lobbyist, and he's falling to the street and
Rob,
he lands
did you
and
have any idea that this stuff existed that early on? Like lobbying?
I was really oh the lobbyist?
Yeah.
No, I not really, but I don't think I was super surprised. I think that
I guess I was surprised because I know it's I know I shouldn't be, but this is like the 30s, man.
Yeah,
So it's
it's
just
like,
holy moly.
even like a lot of this corruption and stuff like that, we hear about stuff and like, oh my God, this is the worst something's ever been. But then you do research or you read something about history and it's like, oh no, actually this stuff happened even like a long
Yeah.
time ago. And so you survive. You can survive this stuff. It's not like it's the end of the world. As much as we don't like the president and stuff, it's like there's been really bad things that have happened before in
Yeah.
the past. But yeah, so I guess I kind of figured that, but you just I mean you just don't you never know for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean it was cool because it picked up like exactly that next scene and he lands on the sidewalk and totally breaks under his landing, and he threatens the lobbyists to get in touch with the actual munitions owner that's been supplying both sides with munitions, and just basically he's just happy to be making money. He doesn't care that there's a war going on that that people are dying from, because this munitions guy is making all this money. His name is Emil Norval. So he tells the he asks him where he is, and he finds out, and the lobbyist gives Norval a heads up that Superman's going to be coming. So he comes in through the window to start threatening the munitions owner, Norval, and he presses a button on his desk, and a bunch of panels from the walls all slide out, and there's like three or four guys with machine guns, and they're just all shooting Superman, and nothing happens, of course. So he wraps all of the Tommy guns around each person's neck and throws them out the window. And he threatens Norval, and he says, "Listen, this is what I want you to do." He's like, "You tomorrow, you need to be on this boat, and it's going to San Monte. And if you don't show up there, then I'm gonna be after you." So he meets up with he finds out the next morning that Lois is going too, because the newspaper editor wanted her to accompany him to the war zone, and what did it say? Send dispatches colored with her distinctive feminine touch. So there's a bunch of different people going on the boat, and Superman comes into Norval's room and says, "And it's a good thing that you got here," and so on and so forth. And but Norval didn't leave enough alone. He brought some shady characters with him, and they managed to actually get Superman up against the edge of the boat, and he kind of loses his balance and he plunges in the water, and they think that he's taken care of and he's dead. And instead, Superman swims past the boat and ends up meeting them on land. When they land and when they dock, and he knocks those guys out, and then he starts yelling at Norval again and says, "Listen, I'm going to give you one more chance. You need to join the San Monte army." So I was like, "What?" So he forces this guy to join the army, and so does Superman. And they're both in the uniforms and stuff, and he's talking to him, and Norval's like, "Are you trying to get us both killed?" And he's like, "Uh-uh." And he's like, "You know, you're gonna see what this is like." And the guy's still insisting that, you know, men's lives are cheap and munitions are expensive, and he's gonna get his money and stuff. And over the course of some battles, of course, Norval starts changing his mind because he doesn't want to die. And so he's like, "See, you know, when it's yourself, the viewpoint changes." So what he ends up doing, Superman ends up doing, is he ends up going into the one tent of one of the generals, and he takes a picture of them planning. He sends it to his newspaper for an amazing scoop, and then Lois is doing some of her assignment work as well. And there's this shady woman, if I can find her name. I can't find her name.
Lola Cortez.
Oh, that was her. Yeah, thanks, Lola Cortez. So she hides some incriminating documents in Lois's room because she's like a spy, and she had them in her own room. So they start searching room to room, and they don't see anything in Lola Cortez, but they find it in Lois's room, and they arrest her and immediately sentence her to be executed at dawn for espionage. So this gets through, Clark ends up hearing that Lois is been convicted as a spy and is going to be killed. So they send her out to be shot, to be executed at gunpoint. and he changes into Superman and runs as fast as he can. He leaps over the wall and he manages to get in front of her just as they start firing. And he picks her up and jumps back over and runs off, saving her. So now at this point, this Superman's getting pretty upset, and he starts getting information from some of the men that are in the army. And the next thing that you see is that he's actually having a fight with an airplane with a machine gun on it. And he jumps up in the air and he starts, he breaks the propeller against his body, and the whole thing starts flying down. And Norville's ecstatic because he thinks that Superman has fallen to his death, but of course he's still alive. And he begs him to let him to return to the United States, and said that he's grown to hate war. So Superman says, okay, but you have to stop making guns. And he agrees to that. So he said the most dangerous thing he's going to manufacture from now on is a firecracker. And so Superman feels pretty satisfied, but he still wants to end the war. So he grabs the commanding general from each side and brings them together and says that they have to fight each other. And they're like, well, why should we fight each other? We're not angry with each other. And he says, well, why are your armies battling? And neither one of them can explain why they're fighting each other. And so they shake hands and decide to be friends. Just like in real life, Mike.
Yeah, just like in real life. It happened in North Korea, South Korea just recently.
Actually, that's kind of funny that it actually did. 70 years. Yeah. So then he comes back home and puts in his story, and the unnamed Perry White is said, you know, since you've been gone, there's been no Superman news. Maybe he retired. And Clark's like, oh, I've got a hunch he's going to be making another appearance soon. So that was the Superman story from issue number 2, which I certainly have never read number 2 before, because I do have a couple of reprints for number 1, both in that, you know, that 75 years that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I also had one of the issues of Action 1 that was like a printing when they had the Superman stamp for the first time, probably about 20, 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so it came the comic book too. So I read it that way. But this was the first time to read issue number 2. So it was fun. I mean, there's a lot of silly moments in it, just like you know, some of the stuff that you were describing. This was a little bit more of a narrative that went from start to end. But
did you notice those weird numbers in the corners?
Yeah, and see, that's what I think are probably newspaper strip things, because they actually, instead of numbering the pages, they're numbering every single panel. It's like, if they were going to do it as a strip, would they have, you know, just done a certain number or whatever, and that's how they were organizing them, so they knew what.
That's highly likely they were shooting for the papers, because remember, they couldn't sell this idea to anybody.
Yeah.
Until they finally took a shot. So maybe they were hit. I mean, maybe they were going to the newspapers. And then, speaking of newspapers, the little coupon at the bottom of Action Comics number 2 is interesting, because it says, help Superman get to your newspaper. Mail this to DC Comics, essentially.
Yep.
And print your local paper, and they'll contact your newspaper and see if they want to print Superman in the comics.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they were saying. And it's funny in the day and age that we live now that, like, well, why is that such a big deal? Like, if you already have a comic book, but back then, like syndicated news strips, like if you had a feature in there that you created, you could make some big money.
Yeah.
If you're just a cartoonist for a comic book, you were not making anything at all.
Yeah.
So that was the big money, was if you're going to do that work, was actually in the newspaper strips, not in the comic books. So that was interesting to know.
This is a interesting collection too, because like the next story after that is not even a Superman story. They're printing a Vigilante story. So.
Oh, I hadn't even looked that far out to next.
It's
oh,
kind
I see
of
that.
An interesting compilation of 80 years of Superman.
I do like that.
I had no idea it was going to be this. I thought it was going to be a hard. I thought it was going to be like the Dark Knight Master Race, where it was a hard cover representation of Action Comics 1000.
Oh, I gotcha. Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought it was going to be.
Well, I like how they have a couple of these other other heroes and stuff in here, you know, since they were part of Action Comics. And obviously Superman's going to be in most of it, but yeah, I didn't realize Vigilante was in there too. I like that.
I don't know how this passed me so long. I'm shocked. I know I've read Detective Batman's first appearance many of times, but I thought I would have read Superman's, and I guess I didn't. And I was blown away. I really was. I got like super pumped. Like I almost want to go down another rabbit hole now. I almost want to stop reading this and go reading the Golden Age hardcover I have that prints it in sequential order.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
This one is just kind of like chronicling the decades. Like here's some for this decade. Here's some from here.
Yeah, exactly. It's fun.
Did you read it, Chris? Have you ever read Action Comics number one?
I think so. The Superman story, anyways. I was pretty sure I had, and then it sounded familiar when you were talking about it. But I think that's the only one, only Golden Age Superman that I've read. Just read it because it was Action Comics number one, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can kind of see what Grant Morrison was drawing on in his New 52 Action Comics with the inspiration that he took for his version of Superman.
Yeah, and that speaking of Grant Morrison, that's in this collection too. It has Grant Morrison's Action Comics number one, so it'll be a good comparison reading that to this, because I'm going to reread it, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to get through this whole hardcover before I actually read, not that I have to, but before I read Action Comics 1000. We'll see if I get through it in time or not, but I'm going to read some more of it today.
Because your alphabet's getting ready to flip over from the Z's to the A's again, so you better...
It is. We're getting close.
Yeah, we're in trouble here.
I got to get going.
All right, Chris, you want to go next?
Sure. Let's see. What should I talk about here? I just read Marvel stuff again. And last time I had talked about Fantastic Four, last time we recorded Fantastic Four 39, so I thought I would talk about the next issue because it was a two-parter. This was where the Fantastic Four were out without their powers, and Dr. Doom found out that they had hypnotized him into thinking that he had beaten them, and so he went for revenge and was able to get control of the Baxter Building while the Fantastic Four were out. And Daredevil happened to be there, well, as Matt Murdock, as their lawyer. And so Daredevil ended up getting involved in helping the Fantastic Four. So at this issue by Lee and Kirby, it's the Battle of the Baxter Building, and it's them attempting to take back the Baxter Building. It's kind of funny. The first
again, you picked a book that I don't own. You have I have 39 and 41, 42, 43, 44, everything after that, but I don't own number 40.
Well, neither do I. Because I read on Marvel Unlimited, obviously, but it's funny. I had talked about, I don't think it was in FF39, I think it might have been in the Daredevil issue that I talked about recently, but they had one of those diagrams of Daredevil's billy clubs, his billy club, and the funny thing about them having done that is that in this issue, it's just it's kind of useful in any situation for what Daredevil needs it to be. For example, probably the most egregious example of that is right in the beginning of the issue, Doom sends out this invention of Reed's that's kind of like a floating surveillance device, floating camera, that he's to locate where the heroes are. And when it comes toward them, Daredevil starts converting his billy club into a a single shot rifle. These prongs come out of the one end, and he pushes them out so it acts as kind of like a shoulder brace, and then he adds a trigger and scope, and fires a bullet out of the end of the other end of the billy club to destroy the floating camera. So I thought that was a little silly, but from there, Daredevil takes off to act as a distraction to Doom so that the four can try to get into the Baxter building, which they do manage to do. But from there, they kind of have to deal with various traps and things like that that Reed had set up that Doom is making use of. But Daredevil manages to sneak in behind through the window behind Doom and act as a distraction for a while. They fight it out. Doom doesn't really know much about Daredevil at this point, so he's kind of impressed and surprised by what he notices as reflexes that are faster than a normal person, that he's able to, you know, detect objects that are flying faster than someone normally would be able to react to and such. Of course, we know why he's able to do that, but so the Fantastic Four are able to get far enough that they're coming up the elevator to the room where Doom is at, and there's an alarm that lets him know that that's the case. So this is kind of like the last moment that Daredevil really has to act as a distraction. Doom, nearly takes him out. He's got some machine shrapnel flying at him. There's another situation where the billy club comes in handy, where it has this sort of telescoping shield that comes out in all directions like a hexagon, and shields his face from some of the shrapnel.
It's almost like Batman's utility belt at this point. It can do anything that he has the need for at the moment.
Yeah, pretty much, to the point that it's a little silly. But it's enough that the Fantastic Four are able to get up to the same level. And when they get there, Daredevil is at this point in basically a fist fight with Doom, and he's struggling with Doom's armor and the amount of strength that it allows Doom to have. When Johnny and Ben, and Ben's a human at this point, they come in and distract Daredevil away from, or distract Doom away from Daredevil. But you know, obviously, as just humans, they're not any better match for Doom's armor. But this allows Reed to get to what is called an electronic stimulator.
Sounds pretty sexual.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. They have used it, has appeared before a few issues back. He used it against the Skrulls. But for whatever reason, he can use it to restore their powers. So he uses it on himself and on Sue. And Doom thinks it's a bait and switch, like that they had just been pretending to not have their powers, and but he's happy to just, defeat them with their powers and get further glory. So he restores Johnny as Doom is holding him, and so he's able to flame on and get free. But obviously that leaves just one of the four without their powers. There's a few pages where Doom further uses some like there's like an in-floor refrigeration unit apparently that he uses to start to freeze the four. They all kind of look like Iceman does at this point, like kind of rough snowmen. And Doom seems like he's getting away. He's not planning to leave or escape at this point yet, but he's just gonna kind of take his anger out on the city. But I think it's kind of funny. There's a panel where Ben, who's still human at this point, he kind of calls attention to a sort of a plot hole that I would have not remembered. But he points out, he asks Reed, if you could get our powers back with that electronic stimulator, why didn't you just do that before instead of creating all these gadgets that he had created in the previous issue to simulate their powers? And Daredevil says, "I'd been wondering the same thing." And Reed explains that the energy had been of the stimulator had been pretty much drained on the Skrull planet, and it needed another few days of recharging. So it just kind of reads as if Stan had forgotten and came up with the solution, and I just wrote that in there to explain it. But it's kind of, then there, so there's kind of a sad sequence where Reed turns the device finally on Ben, and even as Ben is protesting and saying, maybe I don't want to become the thing again, I'm finally normal, and Reed's pretty much comes down to saying, like, tough shit. We need you to fight Doom. And Reed, Sue remarks on how cruel it is, and Reed says, he might hate me after this, but the fate of mankind may hang in the balance. So, and they do really kind of call attention to it. There's a three panel page, which is by far like the least panels on any page in the issue, where it goes from Ben back to the thing. So, methods in question or not, the thing does go after Doom, and takes his anger out on the fact that if Doom weren't there, Reed wouldn't have thought that he needed to change him back. So there's quite a few pages of a pretty good fight between the thing and Doom, where Doom keeps using different devices that he thinks are gonna slow the thing down, and the thing keeps fighting his way through. Quite a long battle, actually. I mean, they devote like one, two, three, four, five, 6 pages basically to this battle between Thing and Doom. And finally, on the last page of the issue, the Thing gets there and crushes Doom's gauntlets, knocks him over, and starts shredding the equipment in his chest. It's when the rest of the Fantastic Four catch up and kind of put a stop to it, that he actually stops beating on Doom. So they pretty much just let Doom go. He crawls away, his armor pretty much wrecked by Ben. But it ends with Ben stating, you know, I'm through with this. He took out Doom, but he's quitting the team because of what Reed did to him. So I know that the next issue goes into the Thing being like sort of a rogue from the team and everything. But yeah, I mean, it was sort of a mixed issue for me because the example of Daredevil's Billy Club is probably the most glaring example, but there's a number of other things that were just super convenient, and I expect a certain amount of that from stories of this era, and I'm fine with a certain amount of it, but it seemed like it had a little more than usual. But then you know, the emotional impact of where they went with Reed and Thing, I know that's a path that they've walked down many times in the future from this point, and like that whole history there in Reed's leadership of the team is something that's really been explored down the road. But I thought it was definitely the highlight of the issue in terms of seeing an early example of that, and definitely a key to kind of you know, the Ben Grimm character that we know now.
Yeah, you know, I've read the first 11 or 12 issues of Fantastic Four recently, and most of them for the first time. And I didn't realize that initially, and I don't know when it stopped, but that he kept that Ben kept briefly changing, or I should say the Thing kept briefly changing back into Ben Grimm for a short period of time, you know, even if it was just minutes or an hour or something, then they switch back to the Thing. I didn't know that at all, so that was kind of surprising to me. So it was interesting to hear in yours that he was Ben Grimm, you know, for majority of the issue until Reed changed him back. So I don't know if that was part of it, or if he changed to Ben Grimm, or, you know, back to human form by another means previously or what. But yeah, that was interesting. That I didn't know that was a thing at the beginning, that he was going back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think early on it was almost like his mutation didn't completely take, or it took longer to solidify. But I think this is the first example, because, you know, they all lost their powers prior to this. And I think this is the first example of Reed intentionally turning him back. That being the real, you know, it's kind of hard to read and think that Reed was, whether Reed was really correct in doing that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Keeps playing with his emotions.
Yeah. It's not really up to him to decide that, or you wouldn't think. So that's kind of controversial.
No, yeah. I mean, the rest of the team at this point, I mean, they were all like, when they first all got changed, they were all freaked out by it. But at this point, like, the other three pretty much want their powers back, you know, because they look normal. He doesn't even get a chance to decide, and Reed decides for him. And,
right.
You know, it's like maybe they needed him to take out Doom, but you kind of feel like they could have managed somehow.
Well, even if they did, I mean, now we're getting into like a serious discussion over, you know, just an old comic book. But
yeah,
even if he did, or even if they did need him, why is it Reed's decision to do that rather than? Do you know what I mean? It's like that's not right at all.
Yeah, in the context of the issue, like Reed justifies it by, you know, there's no time to have that discussion.
Right. But ultimately he's the one. I mean, I understand he's the leader, but yeah, he just gets to make the decision for them. Yeah. You know,
it's a good example of what made why FF was such a solid book back then and a big seller. It's a good example of the sort of dynamic that they had that you just didn't see on a superhero team prior to this.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't see this kind of thing happening on a superhero team.
Right.
And that's why it stood out so much, you know. Not only is it the first time you see Reed do that to Ben, it's probably one of the first times you see anything like that happen between two of the good guys, you know.
Right, yeah, teammates, yeah.
So... but that's definitely one of the things that makes Ben... a really interesting character is that struggle, you know.
Yeah.
Over the years.
He's the guy that you can relate to the most, I think.
Yeah, I mean,
your typical person that reads this, like, not going to relate to Johnny because he's just high strung. And Reed is like, somebody that very few can relate to. Maybe the people from Big Bang Theory can, but I don't know. He's so off-putting and to the record. And this time, Sue's not like as powerful as she's become over the years. So I mean, Ben is like the every guy that went on this rocket ship.
And yeah, he's the everyman.
Turned into a monster, so he's the one that I think when everybody gets emotional or something, it's usually with Ben.
Yeah.
Because he's turned into this monster.
Right. Yeah.
And he has a girlfriend that can't see him really, but can touch him and knows he's a monster. And then Johnny marries her, and she's a Skrull.
Yeah.
I don't apply any of that stuff
retroactively.
I like the drama with Elijah stuff though. It's pretty crazy because Ben still has feelings for her and Johnny's with her and with Alicia and I don't know. It's just weird. I like the FF. I'm glad they're coming back.
Yeah, I'm very excited about it.
Yeah. Matter of fact, I'm drinking a water out of a glass that says Fantastic Pour. it's a beer. The Denver Comic Con does beers off of Geekery. And the one thing that's really great about these beer glasses is the pictures and stuff are dishwasher safe. And usually with most of these things that you buy, the dishwasher will annihilate the imagery on them.
Yeah.
And this one is a really cool tribute to the Fantastic Four. It's got their logo. It just says Fantastic Four. Denver Comic Con's Fantastic Four.
Very nice.
Yeah. Well, I'm a mood reader, and what am I in the mood for? I'm in the mood for trades, it turns out. So I had just finished Spider-Man Clone Saga, and it was a big feat. I mean, that's like 1,000-plus pages of Spider-Man. So for me, it's a big – with my attention span, you know how I switch and I go down rabbit holes. It was a big feat. I finished my first omnibus. I have a lot of omnibuses. I get started on a lot of omnibuses. I haven't finished a lot of omnibuses. It's the first one. I finished the Clone Saga. But and I got emotional during this thing. I mean, Amazing Spider-Man number 400 is probably one of the best comics, one of the best written Spider-Man stories I've ever read. And that is the death of Aunt May, which to me was really, really heartbreaking. But I don't want to talk about the Clone Saga. I finished it. I want to talk about Tales of Man-Bat. This is collecting more of his current stuff. He has four volumes of material. This is the last two volumes of his material. One is written by Chuck Dixon with Flint Henry, I think is the artist. Yeah, Flint Henry. And the other one is by Bruce Jones. And I actually like what Bruce Jones did. I just wish he would have stuck to the horror aspect instead of switching. He switched it and involved Hush and the Black Mask, and it became a really convoluted plot when I thought the horror plot was pretty freaking amazing, and I wish he would have stuck with it. But I've been like in the Hulk mode and kind of stuff like that, and Man-Bat kind of fits that mold. He's a scientist that wanted to improve people's hearing, and he turned himself into a monster, a huge bat. And the one thing I've always loved about that is the relationship he's had with his wife Francine. So if you add horror and you add Francine into the story, I like really like it. And the first story I'm going to talk about is Showcase 94. It's number 11. Back then Showcase 94, I think, featured Batman characters. And in number 11, they featured Man-Bat. And then it had a Starfire backup with one of my favorites, Black Condor. But this particular story, a scientist, an older gentleman, goes searching for Kirk Langstrom in the forests or in the Amazon of some sort. And he takes a guy that's like their muscle and the gun guy. And what's weird is he loves Francine too. So his intent is not to save Kirk. His intent is to kill Kirk. But he doesn't tell that scientist, which they're really supposed to go there to try to trap him and bring him back. And in this case, they go on this adventure. They use this sonic device to draw him out, and they shoot at him. He shoots a trank at him, the scientist guy, and then the guy spends the rest of the time trying to track him down and kill him. And I got distracted. Okay, Barb is helping me catch up. This guy's tracking him down. He falls into a pit and nearly kills himself, and Man-Bat follows him down there, and you just hear a gunshot, and then you know that guy's dead. But I found it was interesting that Francine sent this expedition out there to save her husband, and he's really a monster. Like, all he ever says is Francine. That's all he says. So he like has very little recollection of what's going on, and it makes a big point, like when people are talking, that he doesn't understand what they're saying. But all he keeps on saying is Francine. And this guy was after, he wants to kill Man-Bat. Didn't work out, so he can be with Francine. But it's interesting that this story led into a three-issue miniseries that he did with Flint Henry called Man-Bat. And that was very horror-oriented, too. So I really enjoyed this volume of Man-Bat. It really hit the spot.
That's cool. I've read a little bit of Man-Bat. I haven't read a ton. When he appears in Batman, I do have that old, I guess it's from the 70s, Man-Bat 1 and 2, but That's probably about it. Although I do have the issue that you're talking about. I used to love the. I loved when they did those yearly showcases for those 4 or 5 years that they did them.
Yeah, that was fun. An anthology with Batman characters and Superman characters is where they focused. And then you'd get like some B-list or C-list.
Well, it's nice to get D-list stories.
They
can't support their own series, but you get, you know, have a little bit of stories from characters you don't see a whole lot.
Action Comics did that too when they went Action Comics Weekly.
Back
in the day, which I enjoyed. I like getting an anthology like that from time to time.
I ended up having to drop that at the time just because of money purposes, because it was every single week.
Yeah.
And I couldn't justify spending the money. So now I'm going back and I'm trying to. I only have a few left that I still have to get, but.
Very cool. So you want to go next, Rob?
Sure. So I'm also going through and reading my Batman and Detective comics from where I kind of had a run started, and I had filled a lot of holes over the past couple years. Whenever Gotham by Geeks it started, because just hearing Mike, you were on there for a long time, and hearing you guys talk about old Batman issues, especially. Not like old, like golden age, but some of the stuff that I had bought when I was a kid, it just made me remember like how much I enjoyed a lot of those stories. So over the course of the past few years, I've managed to fill a lot of holes in those gaps. And finally, I completed a run from, I don't remember what number, I think 263 and up for Batman. And I don't remember where it starts in Detective. But anyhow, decided from that point on just to go through and read a bunch of them. So I'm up to Batman 353. So I decided I'd read that for today. And that's from 1982. Jerry Conway was the writer and Jose Garcia Lopez was the guest artist. And the cover of this one is, it's a Joker story. And it has Batman strapped to like a big face, big like monument, a face monument of the Joker, kind of like Mount Rushmore, but just with the Joker's face. And he's got dynamite all around Batman, and he's behind there ready to put the plunger down saying, "Ta-ta, Bats, looks like this will be our final face-off." So how this ends up, how this story starts is the Joker has escaped. He has a new plot. He's looking at a newspaper and he's got a new plot here that he wants to do. And it's like a cold opening, which is kind of cool. He just walks into his into the room and he's got all his minions there, and one of them is kind of disrespectful to him, and he squirts him with his flower, so he thinks he's going to get squirted by acid, but it turned out that it was just water. And so he's, you know, laughing. He's like, "Oh, good joke." And Joker helps him up, and the guy's still kind of like nervously laughing. And a snake comes out from his sleeve and bites the guy and kills him. So Joker pulls out his newspaper and there's two things going on. One, that the Gotham General Station, train station, is going to be demolished. And also that, in a smaller article, Broadway unveils new monument to King of Musicals. So I was looking more towards the main headline with the demolishing. But what it actually turns out is that Joker has a plot that he doesn't understand why he doesn't have a monument in his honor, that he's a lot more important than any musical stars. So as Batman is getting some information and getting some clues, at the time, there had recently been an election where a corrupt politician won the mayoral race with backing of Rupert Thorne, and he had it out for Commissioner Gordon the whole time, so he ended up excusing Commissioner Gordon, and he installed his own police commissioner. So Batman had no notice from the police that Joker had escaped Arkham, because he doesn't have that relationship, and that new commissioner is pretty corrupt. But he ends up finding out, and he starts digging for clues, and he's out actually in New Jersey, across from Gotham, and he sees some dynamite planted along the cliff edge, and Joker ends up sneaking up behind him and hits him with a trank arrow. And when he wakes up, he's tied to the face of the cliff, kind of like the cover, but the Joker's face isn't there yet. And the Joker explains, you know, his motivation that he wants his own monument, and basically killing Batman is just going to be an extra plus. So he has it all set up with computers that he had stolen, actually, the computer that was supposed to detonate the train station, demolishing but retaining its facade that they were going to use for historical purposes. And that computer was stolen, and it turns out Joker had it, and so he's using the same technology with the dynamite to blow stuff up, and it's going to result in a huge Joker face on the side of the cliff. So Batman manages, as they're getting ready, Batman manages to fray one of the ropes to his arm and gets his arm free. And similar to what you were talking about with the Billy Club, Chris, you know, of course, Batman has everything he needs in his utility belt. So he ends up grabbing this little, transmitter that impresses it and manages to jam the signal for the computer. So the dynamite doesn't blow up. He brought it with him expecting that Joker had something to do with it, with the theft of the computer, and was afraid that he was going to try something with explosives. So Joker pulls out his crossbow again that he used to tranquilize Batman earlier, but this time he has a regular bolt in there to try to kill him. But his own men get in his way and start attacking Batman. So Batman's fighting them off, and Joker's yelling at them because he's actually they're blocking him from being able to get a clear shot. And what ends up happening is, as everyone's moving around, he releases his bolt and it hits the actual transmitter that Batman has in his utility belt, rather than Batman himself, and it causes the explosion. So it blows up, and Joker falls into the ocean, and Batman dives in and grabs Joker around the neck and you know, saves him from drowning. And they turn and look, and Batman can't believe it, but there's Joker's face on the cliff. So Joker starts laughing and screaming, it worked, I've won, and so on and so forth. And then suddenly the whole thing starts crumbling because he had used the jammer. It had made the explosives go off in the kind of the wrong sequence, and it wasn't stable. So the whole thing crumbled. And then the last panel is just Batman laughing, and Joker's just with a glum face, and Batman saying that he's had the last laugh after all. And so that was a fun little story with Joker. And there is also a backup story with Batman and Robin. And in this one, it actually stars Robin, where Robin is in the middle of a parade, and he's on the back of a pickup truck helping raise money to fight juvenile delinquency, giving money to the Gotham Boys League. And they're raising lots of money, but of course, you as the reader are tipped off because you hear people in the crowd talking to each other, and someone says, "I've never heard of this this charity, but if Robin's endorsing it, they must be legit." So, of course, that gives you a clue as to what's going on. And the two organizers of this, it turns out, are hardened criminals, and they were basically just collecting the money. And that night, they break into their own charity place and steal the money. So Robin's pretty upset about all of this, and obviously feels responsible. But Bruce says that there's a little bit more to it, and that he wants to take the lead of it, and he appreciates Dick's help, but Batman's gonna take care of it. So Batman has a whole plan to infiltrate his mattress Malone, but Robin doesn't take no for an answer, and he decides to do some stuff on his own. So as Mattress Malone, Batman introduces himself to the two criminals and basically says that he's got $100,000 worth of bonds that aren't good for 6 months, but he needs money right away. So he manages to make a deal with them to take their $50,000 in cash, and he'll give them the $100,000 in bonds. So they agree with this. And at the same time that Batman's going to finalize the deal and actually make the exchange, Dick decides that he's going to pretend that he's Batman. So he uses an inflatable costume so he looks a little bigger than he actually is. And he pretends to be Batman. And he actually ends up breaking up the deal. But then he's surprised to see Mattress Malone, because he knows that that's Bruce. And Mattress punches Batman and actually knocks him out. And the two criminals can't believe it. They're like, all right, let's take care of Batman. Let's get him. And they're like, no, we don't want to do that, because then you'll have every superhero, you know, under the sun after us. Let's just get out of here. So they make the exchange, and then Mattress comes back for Robin, and he explains the whole situation, and that, you know, he kind of almost messed stuff up, but he just needs to, you know, it just comes with experience to learn. And as the two criminals are driving away, you know, they open up the suitcase, and it just has a whole bunch of papers in there that have Batman symbols on it. And the funny thing is that they end up just then getting away. He doesn't arrest them or anything. They're driving out of town in the last panel, which I was kind of surprised that it didn't wrap up with them like tracking them down or whatever. But yeah, so they got free, but they didn't get any money. And it seemed like in that story, Robin was making the wrong decision pretty much every turn. But they're both good stories to read. I'm enjoying going back to these 80s stories. I'll be reading more as I go back to work this week during my lunch hour. So it was fun.
How does that work into your weekly reading plan, the older stuff?
Yeah. It takes a back seat to it. I try to make sure that I try to keep somewhat, I try to keep current with the new stuff. So I'll basically, if I can read five or six new comics a day, I can pretty much keep caught up. So I'll do that like either early in the morning or even in the evening. And then if I'm in a decent place, then I'll like on my lunch hour, I started reading real books again after a lapse of
what?
Over a year. Yeah.
How does that fit in?
Well, I've been alternating. So I might, you know, on my lunch hour, I might read some real book, or I might decide to read one of the old stuff that I'm reading, whether it's old Batman or some trades or whatever, or if it's just a day that like I'm just not able to get, I know I'm not going to get any reading in for current comics, and maybe I'll just read four or five current comics in that hour, because you know you can go through the newer comics a lot faster than the old 80s comics.
Yeah.
So I might get through, you know, five or so in an hour if they're new comics, but I might only be able to read three in an hour if they're the 1980s comics or older. So it all depends on the day, but you know, I try to read five or six new ones a day, and I am trying to cut back a little too, Mike, and I've been somewhat successful, at least with future orders, it looks like.
Wait till you see the next previews, though. Oh, my God.
I already saw it, and it doesn't look good for me. It doesn't look good.
Especially
there's a lot of collections. Yes,
holy moly.
A lot of collected editions.
This has got to be the best collected edition previews I've seen, at least for me, in a long time.
It's got a lot. I'm actually going to... I'm going to start. I just need to. I have to start picking and choosing. So I don't know if I'll get everything on my list that I'm even planning, like wanting to buy. But one thing I already decided I'm not going to buy is like the ANA hardcovers in that one for Valiant. And yeah. I liked it okay. I didn't think it was amazing by any stretch, but I didn't dislike it either, but it's a 12 issue run plus those two one shots.
Yeah,
and it's $50, and even with the discount with DCBS, they don't give you 50% off for Valiant, so I don't remember what it comes to, $30-something, but I'm like, you know what, I need to. We are with the two kids and with expenses, I really need to cut back in terms of money.
Yeah.
So if I really need to read those again, I have those 12 issues and the two one shots. So it's going to be
that
more.
That makes logical sense.
I have.
It's kind of like wasting money, honestly.
Well,
if you already read it and you already own the issues,
own the issues. I don't love it. Like, I would give them like three, like, you know, with your ratings, I'd probably give it overall like a 3 out of 5. I liked it, but it didn't blow me away. But there's the other part of me is like, I have every deluxe edition.
That's hard to overcome, but I'm sure once you overcome it, you're okay.
and I feel
you will live.
Yeah. And I feel okay doing it here because it's kind of like it was the new wave of Valiant books. You know, it was like that second wave where all those original titles had already ended. They started rebooting them. And so it's kind of like for me at least in my mind, I can justify it as a natural transition where now this is the second wave of runs for a lot of these things.
Yeah.
If I really like something, then I'll buy it, like Bloodshot. What was it called? Bloodshot, not Salvation. What was
it? Reborn.
Yeah, Bloodshot Reborn or something like that. But I don't need to get every single one, and I definitely didn't get that omnibus that they released the month before because I already had all those into.
Well, it's a compendium. Yeah, I did just because it's. I have a completion mentality that I haven't been able to break, but.
I can't afford it, and like, you know, when we're going on trips and stuff like that, it's like I can't justify spending the money on that.
Well, it makes no sense.
Yeah.
None of the stuff I do makes sense. So, I mean, I have an engineer brain, and I know what I'm doing isn't making sense, but it's just a compulsion.
Have an engineer job and no kids.
Well, that's the thing.
That's part of it too.
You can afford it, and it gives you pleasure to do it. So, so it's not like it's a bad thing to do, and I would keep doing it myself. It's just I need to cut back.
I've tried to do that, like say, well, I already have it in one form. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But they're coming out with so many good shit, like. The you know how they're doing, I don't know if you get these or you're all in, but I know you got a few, but they have the Arkham Asylum villain trade paperback.
Oh, the Captain Cold. Are you gonna talk about the Captain Cold?
Oh, they're doing the Flash Rogues now. So they have the Captain Cold and they're gonna start doing the so this month they had the Penguin solicited for the Batman and then they had the Captain Cold solicited for the Flash.
See, at least for that, you're talking, I think for some reason,
the Flash
ones are
like $17, and then
so,
plus a discount, so
50% off. It's like I can afford, you know, I can justify doing $9 or $10.
It's $100, and then the omnibuses though, like they're so big, but once I read them, I fall in love with them again because they're not just regular comic size. They're big.
Yeah.
And they are freaking beautiful. And I love the way they collect them because, like, let's say Web of Spider-Man 225 has three stories in it. They tell it in sequential order for the main clone story and then just put the other stuff in back matter at the end after the story arc's completed. So,
Okay.
like, the flow of the story is just continual, whereas monthly it wasn't, you
Right.
know?
That can make a difference too.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I'm doing a little of, not as much as I should, but with the Marvel Unlimited now, it's like I don't have to buy every single thing. Now there are like, like Captain America. I'm gonna buy
Yeah.
Captain America. I'm trying out the Iron Man. I'm trying out the Hulk. But like some of the other ones, it's like, you know what? I'd like to catch up on like Black Panther. I'd like to see what's going on with Death of the Inhumans. But you know what? I can wait. I'll wait for some of this stuff. And when it comes out on Marvel Unlimited, I'll read it at that point because I'm
Yeah.
already paying for that.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to do a little bit more of that,
It's
and I have
all the
bought the cheap
stuff that's in
bucks,
your
but
A list and B list maybe get, but everything else that you're curious about, but you don't think
just
it's going to
wait.
be your favorite, just wait, yeah.
Yep, that's exactly what I'm trying to do now. But it's tough. I mean, you more than anyone can understand. I mean, you understand more better than me. But we're on the same wavelength with the collecting aspect, and it's like it's really hard for me to say, "Oh, I'm not going to have you actually buy this stuff that is just out there for me to read when I want to read it, but I don't actually own it."
Yeah.
But I need to get that mindset at least. For, like you said, when it's not my A-list stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes
So I'm
sense.
trying. But I mean, I looked through the previews and there's a lot of stuff in there that looks good.
Yeah,
Last month
there's
was a
so many
low month for not this.
collected edition Batman stuff. There's
Yep.
their Golden Age stuff is continuing. I mean,
Well, I'm
it's
getting
just.
and I get all the Batman Golden Age,
And
so
now
it's
they have
like
the Marvel Knights stuff coming, which I don't know. In omnibus format, it just.
See, at
I don't
least for
know.
me with the Marvel collections, I'll be like, you know what? I'll just wait. I can read those on Marvel Unlimited, or I'll wait for those. I mean, there's so many of those Marvel sales. It's like
Yeah.
I'll just. I mean, the Comixology ones. I mean, those. I got so many of those 99-cent collections. It's like,
Yeah.
oh my God,
They're really
that's.
starting to populate a lot of spectacular Spider-Mans and Defenders lately.
Yeah, I noticed the
I
defense.
check every Monday, and man, they're hitting the Defenders pretty hard lately. They're starting to fill in the holes.
That's really good news too.
Yeah. All right, Chris, you want to go?
I'll do a short one. 'Cause I read half of Tales to Astonish 68.
Tales to Astonish 68.
I only read the Hulk story. I skipped the Giant Man, which is what I do with these. I don't care about Giant Man.
You don't care about Hank Pym?
No, not at this point. Not. I don't need to read solo stories about him. I gotta skip something. But it's interesting because they had started out Hulk with his own book, and then he got moved over to share this book, and I think the Hulk they kind of it took a little while for them to figure out the Hulk, but it's really this is by Lee and Kirby also, and it's called Back from the Dead. It really is, they're really starting to get their groove with the Hulk. And this, they're kind of got like an ongoing story going at this point. And then the story starts, and Hulk and Glenn Talbot, who is the major that works for, General Ross, and is kind of like a competitor for for Betsy's affections are falling from a cliff in Mongolia, Eastern Mongolia, of all places.
That's where a Black Condor's origin is.
Oh, okay.
Mongolia.
Yeah, that's probably why they
were
there.
Where he was raised by condors in the mountains of Mongolia. You ought to have seen the art in that thing that you guys got me. I don't know if you thumbed through it, Rob, but man.
Oh, I sure did, Mike.
It is freaking beautiful. Like,
yeah, I had to look through it.
It is, I mean, way leaps and bounds better than Action Comics number one in terms of art. But go ahead, keep going.
So, yeah, I forget exactly what happened in the previous story, but I know that Hulk was Bruce Banner when they started to fall, and he turned into Hulk from the shock of the fall. So he doesn't really know who he's rescuing, but he sees Talbot falling. He's man falling, Hulk will catch. And so he saves him and sets him down and tries to talk to him, but Talbot I think is passed out. So Hulk says, oh, I gotta go home, must go home. So he bounces his way back, jumps across the Pacific Ocean, leaping from island to island and from plane to plane. And meanwhile, this is one of the things that, like,
sounded like Fantasy Island there for a second.
The plane to plane, from plane to plane, boss. One of the things that is helping the Hulk stories kind of have more energy is that they've created the leader, which adds a good good antagonist for the Hulk, you know, and he's just basically the opposite, you know, he's the same but the opposite, you know, he's mutated, and he's green, but he's got the intelligence instead of the strength, you know, and that, so So one of the back issues, or one of the back matters of this story is that Bruce Banner had created this invention called the Absorbitron, and I think that's why they were out there in Mongolia, using it as a testing site for that invention, and the leader is wanting to steal that, and he's created these humanoids, these little pink men that are the size of cells. You can only see them, and you can only see that they're men under a microscope. But to the naked eye, it just looks like a pile of like pink dust. These are super Kirby. I have to think that Kirby like came up with this idea because it's so something that he would come up with. So he's going to use those to get the Absorbitron. Well, Hulk is going back home. And as I said, and the thing is like Hulk doesn't know that, he's going to Banner's house and he doesn't know that, that's a bad idea for Bruce Banner, to be back home because he's wanted. And, he just knows that it's a familiar place and that Bruce Banner's not there, you know, because he doesn't know that he's the same person. So he just lays down and goes to sleep. And as he's sleeping, he turns back into Bruce Banner. And Banner wakes up. General Ross and Betsy and a bunch of military police are standing there to arrest him. Banner doesn't have any like defense really, so they arrest him, and then Talbot is trying to he's in Washington and meeting with the senator. He's trying to get Banner pretty much locked up for good and convicted of being in league with communists. This senator actually knows the Hulk secret. It's him and Rick Jones that know the secret of the Hulk. And so he knows the issue is more complicated, and he also has the matter of the Zorbitron in that they need this invention. Meanwhile, the leader is sending, like, he's flying in and dropping a cloud of these humanoids all over the area where the Absorbitron is at. They come and take Bruce out of prison to fly him back to where the Absorbitron is at. Talbot suspects that Bruce is just holding back the details of how to operate it so that they keep having to free him and make use of, you know, keep himself valuable or whatever. But anyways, Bruce and Talbot end up going back, and they're like, Bruce is real suspicious of this powdery pink substance that's all over the place. And Talbot's just, you know, don't you try anything. I'm looking for a chance to put you back in jail, basically. So they go down into the shelter, but Bruce is still looking as they're, like, closing the shelter door at all this pink stuff suspiciously. And as soon as they seal themselves in there, the pink stuff starts to grow, and all these humanoid creatures start growing out like sea monkeys, practically. So they can hear there's some kind of commotion up above, and Talbot opens up the trap door, and they seize him, pull him out. He's trying to fight his way against them, but you know, he's just overwhelmed. There's tons of them, and they break into the base, and Banner gets overwhelmed, and obviously, you know, there's a huge pile on. You just see, like, Banner disappear into this huge pile of pink humanoids, and obviously, you know, at this point, what's going to happen. You know, the Hulk comes out and starts wrecking shop with the humanoids, but then the leader has control over what's going on with these things, and all of a sudden, some gas vapors start emanating from the ones nearest to the Hulk, and he passes out asleep. So it ends on a cliffhanger, which basically, like, the leader is a happy camper because he not only does he get control of the Zorbitron, but he had been hoping to kidnap the Hulk also, because he sees that commonality between them and thinks that, you know, that he could they could team up as radiated green people, and he could, you know, make use of the Hulk. So but yeah, it's cool to see them, like, kind of figure out how to get the Hulk going, and you know, how to create interesting stories with the Hulk. It wasn't something like that they just came, like, right out of the gate understanding, I think.
No, that first, his solo title failed, right? That's why
it
was canceled, yeah.
So, you know, obviously eventually gets his own solo title again, but...
Yeah.
So
I was just looking, because I was just curious. I didn't realize. So this was number 68, right? And... So it looks like Hulk fought Giant Man in 59, and then they started doing the two features in issue 60. So yeah, this is pretty early on.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just kind of ignoring Tales to Astonish, and then when I read the one where the Hulk showed up and started reading the Hulk halves,
mm-hmm.
just like I was kind of skipping the Human Torch half of suspense, or is it suspense, or
yeah, with Doctor
no Strange Tales. Strange Tales. That should have been easy. But then they added the Thing in, so it was the Thing and Human Torch. So I started reading those because I like the Thing. I just can never get enough of Ben Grimm dialogue. Like, I love reading that character. But
don't like Johnny.
Not on his own. I don't care about him on his own. No. I like the two of them together. But I don't care for him on his own. But
I don't think I can read like that. If I read Tales to Astonish, I have to read both.
Yeah. I read both Captain America and Iron Man in those ones. Pretty soon they drop the Human Torch Thing and for the Nick Fury starts pretty soon. Dr. I think there's only a few more. I'll read those. So I'll be reading the whole issue with those pretty soon. But the Doctor Strange ones, I haven't talked about a lot of those stories, but those are really good. The Ditko trippy stuff.
That's cool.
Yeah, I read those when I was a kid because I had I had a Doctor Strange trade paperback, one of those pocket books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, read a lot of Ditko and Stan Lee Doctor Strange.
And when you did shrooms.
Yeah.
You got another one, Mike?
No, I think I'm good. You can go in for another one if you want.
You know what? I'll just mention that this isn't a separate book, but in that Batman 353 that I read, it also had the preview for Masters of the Universe. So it was after the DC Comics Presents issue where Superman and Masters of the Universe, but I guess this preview was leading up to a mini series that they were going to do. And I never could get into the Masters of the Universe comic books, although I had some of the toys that we talked about that when we were talking about that TV show. The toys that made us. But so I went through this pretty quickly, but it was Paul Kupperberg was the writer and Kurt Swan and Dave Hunt were the artists. And basically it's just kind of introducing you to the world for probably for anyone that didn't read that DC Comics Presents. And it has that he's got like a red helmet and a red outfit and white boots. His name's Zodak, and he flies around on like a Metron chair. But so he's introducing us to the world, and Prince Adam is acting basically like a medieval playboy. Everyone accuses him of being out wenching again, and Zodak says that he needs the strongest warrior to leave the world because he's fated to die, and I guess he's supposed to die against Skeletor. Skeletor is half of a power sword and is looking for the other half, and he manages to Beast Man is a minion of Skeletor, and he manages to get Merman to join his cause as well, because apparently the second half of the power sword is deep under the water. What it turns out is that there was a dimensional rift deep under the water that led him to the DC universe, and that's where the other half of the power sword was. So it cuts to Superman flying around saving the day, and there's just this crazy, all of a sudden this crazy aquatic monster starts attacking him. And Skeletor did that to distract him while he could fly through and get the other half of the power sword. Superman gets there just in time, and unbeknownst to him, because he's underwater, he's just going through like a weird vortex that he thinks is like a whirlpool. He ends up in Eternia, which is He-Man's land. And He-Man and Battle Cat have ignored Zodak's command to leave because he might die, and is going after Skeletor. But they have a fight with Zodak first, and then it turns out that Skeletor comes back and he has both halves of the Power Sword. And just as he's going to put them together, Superman grabs them from his hands and throws them. One gets thrown away. The other one, the other half, Skeletor catches again. So because Superman is susceptible to magic, he gets Skeletor gets the best of him and has him on the ropes before He-Man and Battle Cat come. And Skeletor zaps He-Man just as He-Man throws the half of the Power Sword that he grabbed, the other half, into Skeletor. It turns out Skeletor isn't killed, but is only injured, and he disappears. And it turns out that He-Man is not dead, like the way that Zodak had thought he was fated to die, but he recovers, and then He-Man and Superman, Zodak, He-Man and Superman just kind of have a brief conference, and then it says, watch for part one of Masters of the Universe miniseries on sale. So as it was part of the issue, I just decided I would read that too.
That was part of 353?
It was the insert right in the middle, yeah. It was like 16 pages.
It was original content? Like it wasn't reprint?
Yes. Yeah, it was original content, yeah. So, you know, I mean, like I said, I've never been really that invested in any Masters of the Universe comic book content. But, you know, so it was all right for what it was. But it wasn't anything that would have gotten me excited to read the miniseries, that's for sure. So that's all I got.
Nice.
Yep.
You got anything else, Chris, or do you want to wrap it up?
No, I'm good.
All right. Well, you've been listening to Geek Brunch Retrocast, and you can reach us on the Twitter at MythMakingETC as Chris, at Rob Krieger on the Twitter, and I'm at Mike Myers Brunch, and the podcast is located at geekbrunchpodcast.com. You can also find us on Facebook with Geek Brunch Podcast, and click the like button and follow the episode threads there. And I think that's about it. And we'll catch you next time. I'll be up on some Action Comics by then.
Sounds good.
Yeah, golden age. All right, well, thanks, guys. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. All right, have a good Sunday, guys.
You too.
Adios. Bye.